Figuring out what's true or false online can be tricky for everyone, but it turns out older Americans are especially vulnerable to misinformation on social media. Plus, caregivers for veterans are often under a lot of stress. We'll talk about a new study that shows how mindfulness therapy can help. But first, the number of interfaith marriages has been increasing for years. What does that mean when it comes to raising religious kids? Two Chicago filmmakers ask that question in a new documentary called Leaps of Faiths.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, millions of veterans who've returned home are helped mainly by informal caregivers. And those caregivers are often under a lot of stress. We'll talk about some new research about how mindfulness is helping them. Plus, are you good at telling what's true and what's not on social media? We're going to talk about media literacy and why older Americans are particularly vulnerable to sharing misinformation. But first, almost 40% of couples who've gotten married in the past decade are in interfaith marriages. That's a pretty big departure from a few generations earlier. In the 60s, that number was less than 20%. That's according to Pew Research. Those numbers are even higher when it comes to Jewish communities. More than half of all Jewish people who've been married over the past two decades are in relationships with non-Jewish partners. That, and the question of whether you have to choose a religion when it comes to raising your kids, is the subject of a new Chicago documentary called Leaps of Faiths.
One thing that always frustrated me about religion is that it divides people.
People who are of various traditions fall in love.
Jews and non-Jews. And then they ask, well, now what are we going to do?
So many people are in interfaith marriages, interfaith relationships.
The majority of American Jews are partnered with someone not Jewish. There are more children growing up in a home with one Jewish parent than with two.
This is something that we've definitely discussed and worried about.
The documentary premieres on WTTW Chicago this evening at 9 o'clock. For those of you who are listening in other parts of the state, it will also be available online. We'll have all of that information up at our website. We're joined now by co-writers and director David Kovacs and Steve Ordower. Dave, Steve, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
Good to talk to you.
David, I wonder if we can start with you and ask why you were interested in this topic and making a film about interfaith relationships and families.
Sure, Nyla. My wife and I have been married 32 years. She's Catholic. I'm Jewish. And we've been part of the formation of some groups and a unique kind of religious education program in Chicago where parents teach their children both their faith traditions. And we just kept seeing amazing moments of connection and clarity and wrestling with some of these issues that Steve, who's a documentary filmmaker, I'm a writer, we said, I think there's a documentary here.
And so that's the Interfaith Family School, David. That's what you're talking about, right?
Right. We call it the Family School. If you see it online, it's the Chicago Interfaith Family School. And there's another school called the Union School in Mount Prospect, a suburb of Chicago. So there are two schools in the Chicago area.
So that's really what this documentary focuses on. As we talk to David and Steve, I want to invite all of you listening, especially if you're in an interfaith marriage, we'd love to hear what sort of challenges you face. You can text us your thoughts at 217-394-5765. We'll read them on the air. Again, that's 217-394-5765. Don't forget to include your first name and your hometown. So, Steve, you guys are talking to a lot. You talk to lots of different people that are involved with this interfaith mm-hmm. with the family school. And I think it's interesting to me that in the documentary, it seems like the couples are pretty open to figuring this out, but maybe it's the others around them who are not, whether that's more times than not their families or perhaps sometimes religious leaders. Did you find that was the case with a lot of the folks that you guys interviewed?
Well, you know, it's interesting because what I found to be so inspiring about this story was that when you know, oftentimes people will pick a spouse based on their circumstances or conventional wisdom or the societal, you know, paradigms that they live among or within. But with these couples, that's quite the opposite. They've chosen someone really powerfully, despite what the rest of society or their family members or their friends say about everything that can go wrong. And they have to be very proactive in not only loving another person, but accepting them and creating their world from that point of view, as opposed to, does this person fit into my predetermined boxes? And what's so inspiring about that is that most of these couples have stayed together for quite a long time, and their relationships are very strong because they're grounded in like genuine acceptance, not the type of acceptance people think they're engaging in oftentimes, but you know, it's got to be real, because there's no way your relationship can last if you're married to somebody from another cultural group. And you know, the religious divide is one of the hardest barriers to cross. But when you're married to somebody, you can't. It's not going to last unless there's some real acceptance happening.
David, I wonder how we see that acceptance, how that works with the family school. Can you tell us about how it works with how this got started and what kind of things people do?
Sure. And it really gets into the larger question of, you know, the numbers you quoted, there are so many interfaith families, and they all make different choices. Some choose to raise their children Jewish. Some choose to raise their children Christian. Some say that, well, kind of be culturally religious, but we're not going to have religion in the family. Mm-hmm. And there are some people who've said, well, what about this learning two faiths? So when the family school started, it was a small group of families, seven families, and that kind of underscores the importance of community. People have asked us in other cities, oh, how can we start this? Can we homeschool our kids? Send us the curriculum, and we're happy to share what we do. But, you know, there's really this community element of kids learning together side by side that is sort of the magic of how this happens, and the fact that we couldn't really hire a Jewish teacher and a Catholic teacher in the very beginning to teach these classes. It had to be the parents. And because the parents teach together, they're learning right along with the kids. So it really kind of unfolds through our kindergarten through eighth grade curriculum. And as a result, these kids, and there's, you see them in the film, we have a video of them in eighth grade talking about what it's been like to learn these two faiths, what it is to explain to other people, you know, how their religious outlook looks. And then because the school's been around for 25 years, we have kids in their 20s who've grown up. We hear them in eighth grade, and then we hear them in their 20s. Mm-hmm. And it's powerful to hear how people's how they look at life and religion and, you know, these deeper questions. It changes as they grow.
Right.
Yeah,
so,
and I just wanted to add to that, if I may. It's that was also one of the most inspiring parts of the story, because it gives me hope for the future, listening to these young people coming up and how their way they view the world in terms of their critical analysis is really wonderful to see.
And so now you guys have, you do have Father John Cusick, Rabbi Alan Setcher, who are working with you all now. How do you handle, as you're talking about the inspiration that you have from these kids, David, I wonder how you do talk about the really hard questions here about the theological differences between Catholicism and Judaism to start with.
Right, Nyla. And you know, we also have Rabbi Evan Moffick and Rabbi Ari Moffick and other rabbis and priests who are in the film who've worked with us. And, you know, Rabbi Evan Moffick is very clear, you know, in articulating the theological differences and that they're real. And you can't just push them aside. And Will, one of our students who's grown up into his 20s, makes that point very clear. And he and Anna, his classmate from years ago, kind of get into an interesting discussion about it. You know, how do you wrestle with the theological differences, and are they important? And so, that's the way that we tried to, be true documentarians here and show the different dimensions of these questions, and that, this is really about wrestling, and in the wrestling is what's fascinating.
Yeah, and it's a productive wrestling. It's a productive questioning. It's a productive learning and growing. And so as opposed to, putting aside the differences, we welcome them. And that's what we set out to document.
And then the last thing I'll add is we kind of were selfish in making this film because we've been curious. How do these kids grow up? Did we do the right thing by making the choice we made of how to raise our kids? And we kind of were rolling the dice saying, well, we'll teach in the choices we made. We'll teach them both faiths. We'll let them self-identify religiously as they grow older. And it'll be up to them to decide what their religious path is in life. And so by putting them on camera and asking them those questions, we kind of got some answers that we're excited to share with everybody.
And I want to go back to one of the things you were talking about, David. You were mentioning some of the now young people who have gone through this, and you mentioned Anna. I mean, when you think about the fact that these young people that you guys have helped raise up, to have these in this religious environment to sort of whether they're in, it's all about the choices and also how they're deciding to have their religious beliefs and their spirituality. Obviously, that doesn't stop people from passing judgment on that. And I wanted to just play a little bit of Anna from the film talking about she's 23 now and reflecting on some things that happened to her, particularly when she was in Israel.
I took a trip to Israel with my parents and my grandparents. My grandma was a spy during World War II, Jewish spy, so she's a survivor. We were at dinner one night with our tour guide, and eventually he turns to me and starts asking me questions about what I believe. He's like, well, you're not full Jewish, you're half Jewish. And eventually he looks at me and goes, oh, well, you're Hitler's success, right? You're not a Jew. And that will stick with me for the rest of my life.
That's Anna from the film Leaps of Faiths, the documentary. We're speaking with co-producers, directors, David Kovacs and Steve Ordower. So, that's really tough to hear. And I think that's maybe something that a lot of these families have to deal with maybe on different levels. Steve, I wonder how often you found, as you were also in this community, that people were dealing with situations like this.
Well, this is what was so interesting about documenting this story, is because in the adult educational conversations that we'd have among the parents, the honesty was so striking, and the stories, albeit different, to whatever degree, there were a lot of similar patterns in terms of judgments passed, particularly from the family members. That's where most of the judgment came from.
And you mean outside of the core unit of the family, right?
Outside?
Grandparents, aunts and uncles, those sorts of, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. I've been a bit, David would probably be better to answer that, because my kids don't know any other reality. And they're younger than David's kids. They're 12 and 9. So, some people ask them some questions, but they go to public schools. And David, why don't you speak to that?
Yeah, my kids are 30 and 27, and they've always considered themselves both Jewish and Catholic. And it's interesting, that quote that you played of Anna, the next thing she says, I'm a full Jew and a full Catholic. Some kids describe themselves as I'm half Jewish and half Catholic or Christian. I think when our kids went out into the world, like many teenagers and young adults, they said, well, you know, I mean, my daughter's into theater, my son's into music. That's their religion. That's their community. That's what, you know, drives them and answers some of the larger existential questions in their life. But now that they're, my son's married for 4 years, my daughter's engaged, the people that they meet, my son married a woman who is Catholic. So they'll probably have more of a Catholic way of living their life, but they're never going to lose the Jewish part. And I think kids, especially millennials, have such an ability to, you know, live in more than one world. And that's kind of where our kids are.
We just have a minute or two left, but David, I do wonder, I mean, we started this conversation looking at the demographic trends and how much this is just really a becoming a much more common reflection of society, of interfaith families. What are you hoping people take from this documentary?
Well, I hope that people will find their own stories, whether, again, regardless of how you raise your kids, there are different pathways through here, and they're all valid if they work for your family. I would hope that people find their story and are able to share it with other people and to say, let's build a community in our area of interfaith families. Let's let our kids play with each other and realize that they're not different. They're similar. And let's, I think community is so important. And for people who would say that this is about, you know, the what about the future of the Jewish community, I would say, and I know Steve would say too, look at all these Christian people that in our just in our community alone who've gotten to know Judaism on this incredibly personal and deep level and feel when there's marching in Charlottesville about anti-Semites. They feel it just as Jewish people do. And there's a place for them in the Jewish community.
So that's Leaps of Faiths. It's premiering on WTTW Chicago tonight, the public TV station in Chicago. It's also available online. We will have all the information about this up at 21stshow.org. I know you guys are also doing a couple screenings around the Chicago area over this summer as well, right? But I want to thank David Kovacs and Steve Ordower, both of them directors and co-producers of Leaps of Faith films, Leaps of Faiths film about the Chicago Interfaith Family School. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you,
Kyla.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you think back to the 2016 election, it was a time when it seemed like fake news and misinformation was everywhere on social media. Since then, we've learned more about how misinformation spreads online and how well-equipped we are to handle it. There's also been an increase in funding for programs that promote digital and media literacy, supported in some cases with money from tech giants like Apple and Facebook. But many of those are designed for young people, even if a growing body of research suggests that our oldest citizens are the most vulnerable to false news and misinformation on the internet. That's the subject of a recent piece by Craig Silverman. He's BuzzFeed's media editor, and he joins us now from Toronto. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thank you.
Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Lisa Jamis. She's the manager of local programs at AARP. And in studio with me here in Urbana is Carol Tilley, who teaches at University of Illinois School of Information Sciences. Lisa, Carol, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Craig, I wonder if we can start with you and just ask when you feel like researchers started to learn more about the effects of misinformation. Was it the 2016 election and the immediate aftermath?
The 2016 election and the immediate aftermath, and I think to a certain extent, the surprise that so many people had that Trump won, I think even Trump himself to a certain extent was surprised. There were a lot of people, average folks, as well as professionals and researchers who wanted to try and figure out, well, what were the factors that led to a surprising result? And I do think that suddenly a narrative about misinformation, about false stuff, particularly false things spreading on Facebook, that was part of the discussion. And so you had researchers, some of whom had been looking at that beforehand, but a bunch who kind of flooded the zone on this because it was suddenly an area of big interest. Whereas in the previous, you know, years, as somebody who was writing about this, it wasn't as much of an interest. And so, yeah, we had researchers who started to gather data, longer-term studies, gather bigger data sets and look at bigger groups of people. And that sort of created a little mini boom over the last couple of years of really looking into that, with the data around the 2016 election being the main thing folks are focused on.
And Craig, are we mostly talking about Facebook when we're saying misinformation, or are there other places we're looking at this happening?
I do think that overall, our media ecosystem now, I mean, one of the great things about it is that it's much more democratized. It's easier to get your voice out as an individual or a smaller group, and that's a really good thing that the internet has done. At the same time, of course, when you have lots more voices, it's more chaotic, it's a more confusing environment. And so while Facebook is incredibly dominant, I mean, we're talking about 2.5 billion people around the world at least logging in every month, and a lot doing it much more frequently than that. That's the biggest population. But the truth is that we do have misinformation, meaning, you know, misleading stuff, false stuff that is spreading across all platforms. So it's not just a Facebook problem, but Facebook, if you're going to study it, that is the place that the most people are. That is the place where there's so much engagement and so much activity. And studies have also shown in recent years that it is a place that increasingly Americans and others are getting their news from.
So, Carol, when we think about that, I wonder if we can look at some of the research that points to the fact that older Americans are being more likely to share false news online. I mean, how much of that is also because of as we've seen the demographics of Facebook skew older?
I think there is something to the aging demographics of Facebook. But one of the things is I look at some of the polls and studies from Pew and other sites. There is, of course, a difference between, say, the under 40 age group and the over 40 or over 50 age group in terms of how they understand fake news and fact versus opinion. But I don't see such a huge difference between the two groups. I see it really as a smaller difference. I think that there are some shared problems, some shared lapses across all ages when it comes to thinking critically about information and knowledge.
And Carol, I wonder when we're thinking about older Americans, if it's just not something we talk about very much or think about, even if it's perhaps facing the same problems that you're seeing, regardless of age, when it comes to media or digital literacy. It's just that maybe we are leaving out older Americans in this conversation.
I think that's part of it, in part because I think as a culture, we tend to think of technology as a youth-focused sort of network, a youth-focused information tool. But it's clear that with social media, we're seeing adoption across a wide variety of age groups. I just think that older Americans in particular are, as you said, somewhat more invisible.
Lisa Jamis is also with us from AARP. Lisa, I wanted to ask you about the work that you do with the Learn at 50 program and share some comments that we've been getting, because, of course, we went to Facebook to ask our older listeners what they thought about this. Patty from Berwyn said, this is a comment she posted on our Facebook page. She said, I am almost 70 and I can spot a comment by a Russian troll. I use my computer to fact check anything I doubt is true, and I share only what I know to be true. How common is a statement like Patty's mindset among the folks that you're working with, Lisa?
Well, I can tell you that the technology workshops that we host in 38 markets across the country, we have everyone from your basic learner to someone who's there to learn even beyond the basics. Mostly the feedback that we get from the 50 plus who are attending those workshops, they are actually there more to, sometimes they'll talk about, I want to be safe online, which we do teach in the class, but they're also there really just to learn and connect and be able to connect with their grandkids and their family. So what we're finding is we don't have a lot of people coming into the workshops that are fearful. We do teach them the basics. Some of them, it's very basic, and we do teach them how to be safe online, but really the focus is helping them connect and be engaged and be challenged as they move through this, you know, this ever-changing digital age.
That's Lisa Jemis with AARP. Craig Silverman is with us from BuzzFeed. And Craig actually attended one of these tech workshops in Washington for his story that he did. Craig, can I ask you, when we're thinking about whether it's folks at this workshop or just when we're looking at the population, Carol's point is that she feels like media literacy is a problem across age groups. But I wonder if there are factors that find that older Americans might be more likely to share misinformation.
I absolutely agree that we do have to think about this as not strictly a problem for the young or a problem for the old. We have a dramatically different media environment. I think all of us struggle to a certain extent with it because it has changed so much so quickly. So it's, you know, it's good to focus on centers of the population that maybe seem a bit more vulnerable, but I think all of us should be wary of being too overconfident because it is a chaotic environment. And I mean, in terms of what we see with some of the other factors, you know, the researchers that I spoke to, they talk about the intersection between things like, you know, the levels of isolation and loneliness that some older Americans do experience. This is part of a kind of generational shift in the sense that there was a time when often the grandparents lived in the same house as the younger generations, and that's less common today. And so you have older people who maybe had the experience of living with their older relatives when they were younger, and now they're not doing that when they're older. And it's a different dynamic. And technology can be a wonderful benefit to that of, as you hear from AARP, of keeping them connected. But it's also if, you know, if the guardrails aren't there for all of us online, any person can go awry. And I think that is something that is affecting older folks. It's not affecting anyone over 65. There are people with different levels of skill, as you hear. But as a sort of group of population, the researchers I've spoken to who've been doing this research, you know, when they control for other factors like partisanship or other things, they're saying that age is increasingly coming out as something across studies. It's not just one study, but, you know, four different ones looking at the sharing and consumption of misinformation around 2016. All of them found that age seemed to be a factor that really stood out.
And Craig, to that point about that age being a factor, I also, in your reporting, you talk a little bit about the rising power of older Americans. And I think most people know that older Americans vote in larger numbers than other generations. But when we're thinking also just about demographics and we're looking at American culture, when we're looking at our rapidly aging population, this is also one of our largest age groups, right?
It is. And within not too many years, it will be the largest age group. You know, there's a titanic shift happening in the demographics of the United States and also countries like Canada, where you will have at a point have more people over 65 than more people, you know, under 25 and under. And that's not a typical demographic breakdown that we've seen in our societies. And so this is something where older people, you know, they already have a lot of kind of economic power, political power, because they vote and they're active and they're passionate. And that's probably going to increase. And I think it's really important to think about ways of making sure that they're part of all the conversation, that they're also adapting and that people are supporting them when it comes to technology and new things. Because if we all struggle and some of us struggle more, it's something we should think about how we support each other. And that, to me, is one of the big takeaways, is it's not about shaming older people or lumping them all into one group. It's about thinking about how can we as a society support everyone for these challenges, but also identify who maybe deserves a little bit of extra help.
And Carol, to that point, regardless, as we're saying, regardless of age, how do you feel like people should, when we're thinking about media literacy, how do you know how to spot what's true or not? You know, this is something that I, as a journalist, do on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. But I think even as Craig was talking, I was just thinking about the different kinds of forms of media and how that's changed during my lifetime, right? And how going from whether you were watching the evening news and that was your source of information, or you were reading a newspaper, and now as we're talking about more people getting their information from places like Facebook, how do we really determine whether or not something's true or not?
That's tough, even for folks like me who have a PhD in information science, and I've worked as a librarian, and I teach folks about this.
I mean, journalists
topic.
Get pulled sometimes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. I caught myself sharing something on Facebook last year that someone pinged me. I usually, you know, like triple check, and someone caught that and said, no, you just got had. But I think that one of the things that has to happen is just sort of this disposition to always be critical, to persevere, to check multiple sources. And that's tough because you can encourage people, I think, to do these things. You can put up reminder sheets. You can have programs. But at the end of the day, the disposition is, at some level, has to be intrinsic. It has to be internal. And people just have to want to do this.
And we want to share information quickly, right? Craig, I wonder to that point, and Lisa, I would love to have you chime in on this as well. How much do you think the platforms and tech companies are basically designed it that way for us to just really make sharing so easy that we're not really thinking about checking things?
I mean, that is absolutely what they're optimized for. They're optimized and built to reduce all the friction, and they want you to interact. They want you to, whether it's, you know, a like or a share or a retweet, they want that interaction because obviously that, you know, that's a signal that they can then take and figure out, okay, a lot of people like this piece of content, let's show it to other people, and hopefully that gets everyone spending more time on it. So that's their bias. And what we have to realize is that people have become very good at exploiting that and understanding on a platform like Facebook what kind of content is going to get people to have that quick reaction to sort of not have them sit and think about it. And what we've really seen is that it's all about emotion. It's all about getting anger or extreme happiness. It's about getting people to have an emotional reaction to a piece of content that causes them to have a sort of intrinsic reaction to like and share. And so for me, like, the big piece of advice for people is try to cultivate a certain amount of emotional skepticism. If you see something online and it makes your blood boil instantly, or, you know, it confirms everything you thought about someone, that's the moment where you should actually train yourself to pause just a little bit and ask yourself, where is this coming from? Am I familiar with this, you know, news outlet or website? And are there other sources saying the same thing? And that emotional skepticism, I think, is really important because of the way these platforms are built.
We got a comment on Facebook from Cindy who said, I just don't believe anything I hear. So clearly she is agreeing with you with that, Craig. Lisa, when you're thinking about the training that you guys are doing at AARP, how do you test whether programs like yours are working?
We actually our tech programs, which, as I mentioned, like to date, we've already done over 3,500 since 2014. It's one
wow.
of our most popular.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's amazing. We're doing 1,200 workshops this year. And they fill up, and they fill up fast. As a matter of fact, we have a number of workshops running in Chicago, if your listeners are interested. What we also do, not only do we get anecdotal feedback, a lot of times I personally will attend these workshops, and you can just hear the excitement and the passion. They're very interactive. They're hands-on. People are able to ask questions. But what we also do, we do surveys at the end of our workshops. And the satisfaction rates on those surveys are above 90% across the board on, you know, the technology and information I'm learning today is going to help me. The instructors were knowledgeable. AARP is helping me navigate, you know, technology in the digital age. So the technology classes are very, very popular and very well received. And I also want to shout out that at learn.aarp.org, if you go to in-person learning, AARP features all of our in-person classes that cover not just technology, but also caregiving and work jobs.
So I wanted to just wrap up here with one last Facebook comment we got, and it was from Penny in Decatur, and she said, quit making the assumption that we are as uneducated as younger people. And Carol, I wonder what your thoughts are on that, because I wonder if this really, it's not about education, right?
No, for me, in looking at the data and in talking with students, what I see is it's about the things that interest us, that engage us, and that sort of intrinsic motivation is what gets us to push past our biases, I think. Not always. It's not about age. It's not about education always.
Craig, I imagine you also want everyone to know that this is not about attacking an older generation. But I also wonder kind of what your biggest questions are after you've reported this piece, what you have going forward here.
But, you know, for me, the question is, what is the best way to engage with this group and to give them the skills they need? Because I do think, as much as we all struggle, there are probably different approaches to teaching and learning for different groups. There's been a lot of money, as you mentioned off the top, that has ended up really focused on younger students. And I feel like there's a focus there and there's still a lot of work to do, but it seems like it's starting to move in that direction. And so for me, the next question is, well, how do we get this out to people of all age groups, but in particular the folks who are in the older age groups? How can we test things to see what resonates most with them and serve them and support them in ways that are going to be really helpful? I think thinking about those solutions and programs is another piece that's really important now.
That's Craig Silverman. He's the media editor at BuzzFeed, joining us from Toronto. I want to thank Lisa James for being with us as well. And we'll have those resources that Lisa mentioned, the sites that she mentioned about AARP at our website at 21stshow.org. We'll tweet those out as well. We'll post them on Facebook, on every social medium, so you can see them. I want to thank Carol Tilley for being with us as well, U of I School of Information Sciences, where she is an associate professor. Craig, Carol, Lisa, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This year, it's estimated that more than 200,000 service members will return home, and they join 18 million veterans who are already living in the U.S. What does care look like for those 18 million vets? According to the RAND Corporation, about 5.5 million of those are helped primarily by an informal caregiver. That could mean anyone from a spouse to a sibling, a parent, or child. It also means these informal caregivers are balancing careers, relationships, and other responsibilities of their own while taking care of their loved ones. Now, a new study from researchers at the University of Illinois finds that mindfulness may help alleviate some of that stress for caregivers. Kinesiology and community health professor Sandra Luz Lara Sinisomo is the study lead, and she's in our studios in Urbana now to tell us more about her research. Sammy Anderson is also with us. She's one of those informal caregivers for her husband. Sandra Luz, Sammy, thanks for being here with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I wonder, Sammy, can we just start with just hearing a little bit more about what your life is like being an informal caregiver? Can you tell us about your husband, Garrett, how long you guys have been married?
Sure. Garrett and I have been married almost 15 years. He was injured when we were actually married. I apologize. We'd been married 6 months when he was injured by an IED in Baghdad, Iraq. He suffered what we referred to as traumatic injuries. So they rebuilt half of his face. He lost one arm. He suffers from a traumatic brain injury. And so when he returned with these injuries, I was a 6 month newly wife. Mm-hmm. And the Department of Defense said, here's your husband. Start taking care of him.
Yeah.
Almost immediately. Once he landed at Walter Reed.
And what did that look like? I wonder, in the beginning, what was it like? I mean, I imagine in the beginning, you're kind of just in this emergency mode of just, how can I take care of my husband?
Well, and I was 26, 27, and I had never experienced anything really traumatic like this. So physical injuries that look like this. So when I walked into his ICU room and he was in a coma, I wasn't really prepared. That's a shocking thing to walk into.
Yeah, how can anyone be prepared for that, right?
Right. And I had never taken care of anything, like plants even, just myself. So to be given this responsibility, it was pretty much I call a sink or drown method to where you figured it out. The Department of Defense, all those years ago, they didn't provide classes. There wasn't resources. There wasn't help. And there were significant amounts of injuries coming back from Iraq at that time. The hospital staff was actually overwhelmed.
Yeah, so this was 2005.
Correct.
I wonder if we can fast forward to today and ask, you know, you guys have kids.
We do.
Been married for more than 15 years at this point, right?
Right.
What does a typical day look like now as you think about you balancing your career, your kids, your husband? What does the informal caregiving part of that look like for you?
We refer to it as controlled chaos because there's so much on our plates every day, and it will overflow to my children. So where Garrett lacks in his abilities, I make up for. If I'm not there, my 12-year-old makes up for. For example, his memory. So forgetting things, not remembering certain things that, you know, he may have to make a stop on the way to school for something. My 12-year-old, because I'm not in the car with them, she'll remind them. So it's just, it's a crazy kind of daily life, just trying to figure it out.
It sounds pretty stressful too.
It is. It is. So it's almost like you have to learn how to manage it. And I call it, you learn how to kind of stuff it in.
So. Mm. How would you say that stress, if we're thinking about just even the past couple of weeks, how do you think it affects you personally?
Well, after 15 years of caring for my husband and having kids and working, I had my first ever panic attack. And you could not have convinced me at the time that I was not dying. I literally thought I was having a heart attack. I argued with the ER physician, which, by the way, she was wonderful, that I'm dying. Go figure out why I'm dying. And so she had such an enormous amount of patience, but I had never had that. And she said, you've been living this way for 15 years. It's bound to happen.
Sammy, thanks for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Sandra Luce, I wonder how often you hear stories like this. Unfortunately, I imagine it's pretty common.
Yes.
Because we talk a lot about veterans, yes, but we don't necessarily talk about all the people who are there to help them.
Right. They have their own story. They have their own experiences. And like Sammy said, a lot of them don't have orientation to how to care for the veteran. The veteran comes with sometimes very complex health and mental health needs that then the informal, often a spouse or another family member, then has to manage and provide services that they aren't really prepared to provide, but must do so in the interest of the well-being of that individual and the family.
And so when you say in your research, you talk about a caregiver burden, these are the kind of things you're talking
about.
Yeah,
the things that Sammy also illustrated are really kind of this allostatic load, this buildup, this accumulation of stress that happens for the caregiver who has to manage multiple responsibilities over a long period of time with very little resources often, very little breaks. In our research, we found that most of our caregivers are doing it on their own. They just kind of endure it. But this is a mentality that we found in spouses of active service members. This is a committed family to begin with. And they're enduring and hardworking, and they're going to see it through one way or another. But it has consequences.
So how would you, I wonder, before we even get into the whole idea of the mindfulness techniques that you were doing in your study, maybe you should explain a little bit about what you mean when you say mindfulness and how this can help people in stressful situations.
Yeah, so mindfulness is really, you know, we talk about being more aware, being less judgmental. There are special skills that you learn, like what's called a body scan, paying attention to your whole body, thinking about your thoughts without reacting to them, having feelings, naming them and not judging them, observing your environment. And so it's really more of a self-awareness, less of autopilot, just react, more of, okay, what is happening? What am I feeling? How am I responding? What are the words that I can use to describe those feelings?
And so how did this help caregivers, particularly of veterans?
Well, mindfulness helps you kind of slow down, calm down, pay attention. And in our exit interviews, one of the caregivers said that her husband noticed that she doesn't react as much to him, that she's calmer, and that's helping him calm down. So through the training, the caregivers learned how to pay attention to their own thoughts, to their body, to their physical responses to a stressor or an aversive experience. And so they're taught to slow down, to name those experiences, and to reflect on them without feeling bad about them or feeling guilt.
Sandra Luce, how did you do that here with the study? Did you have people in a group that you taught these techniques to and then you surveyed them?
Yeah, so we enrolled 23 participants in the Champaign, Urbana, and Danville area. They were randomly assigned to the intervention, which is an 8-week program for 2 hours a week. All the participants who were assigned to the intervention would come in. They'd get training by two very highly trained doctoral students who are trained in mindfulness and are very well versed in the technique. And so for 2 hours a week, they'd come in, learn, and then they'd go home and practice, and they had to log that practice. Now, we had a wait list that then we offered the intervention to as well, because we thought it would be ethically and responsible for us to do so.
Right, because what did you find? Because it sounds like you found that this was something that was really helpful for people.
Absolutely. We found that compared to the wait list control individuals, those people who had to wait the 8 weeks before they could access the services, that those in the mindfulness training reported significantly fewer stress symptoms. Anxiety and worry was significantly lower. In fact, we saw some of those symptoms go up in the waitlist group.
Mm. And so, Sammy, I imagine this would be something that would be really helpful for you, it sounds like.
Right, it would be. I mean, just going back to what I had talked about with the panic attack, what triggered it for me is because I had a medical emergency and was told I couldn't go to work for a week, that's what triggered it. I mean, who gets a trigger over being told, take time off, don't go to work for a week? But that's what happened to me because not having that ability or understanding of mindfulness, I know how to accomplish a goal and get what I have to get done every day. I don't know, no one ever taught caregivers from my time period to step away and learn those skills. We mm-hmm. didn't have that.
Sammy, I wonder if you think there's something also, I was just going back to something Sandra Luce said about military families being a tight unit, being people thinking like, I'm going to get through this no matter what. Do you think that there's something about that that would make people particularly both challenging to accept, but maybe to accept mindfulness, but also at the same time, maybe even more receptive to it? I wonder how you think people in a military situation might respond to something like this?
Right. I think for like Garrett and I would call it dangerous resilience because the military did kind of ingrain in him and then me kind of by absorbing
what that culture. Was,
yes. Mm-hmm. That you just get through it. Whatever challenge is in front of you, it's the suck it up mentality and get to where you need to be the best way possible. And there wasn't any of this extra take care of yourself. Your inner being is important. I didn't realize I could get fatigued and have that reaction because it was so strong. I feel so bad now for people who experience that on a regular basis. Yeah. It was really eye-opening because that is like, it's scary.
It's debilitating.
Oh my yeah. gosh, yes.
I wonder also too, Sammy, when, again, like to my point about we think a lot about how we can support veterans. Do you think we have enough conversations about how we could support the caregivers of veterans?
No.
I mean, what would you like to see? What kind of more conversations would you like to see around this?
Well, the way that the DOD and the Department of Veterans Affairs is set up is primarily to focus on the veteran. I completely understand that. But so much with these injuries coming back, because our medical care is phenomenal in combat zones, our injuries coming back are so significant. The resources for the family members taking care of that veteran, it's like a tiny percent of what the VA does.
Yeah, if I could just jump in. In fact, our preliminary research showed that there are very few services that actually match the needs of the caregivers. And so this was one of the impetus for this study, that we identified this huge gap in services, but also in providing some kind of resources that the caregivers would have at their disposal at all time, that they wouldn't have to call someone to help them, that they could then develop a whole new tool of resources that they could use on their own for the rest of their life.
Sandra Luce, so where do you want to go next with this research? What do you think needs to happen, especially as we're talking about helping folks like Sammy and her family?
Yeah, so I have submitted grant proposals to extend this work. I am working with other researchers in Chicago who are affiliated with the VA there, but also at the RAND Corporation where I used to work. I still have collaborators there. We are interested in launching this and making it a wider reach intervention, but also in identifying the needs that caregivers have. The research does show that there is a need, but we don't know specifically the type of services that they can benefit from. So we need to do that.
Right. So this initial research is really promising. Something I think really important and appropriate to think about as we head into the Memorial Day weekend. I want to thank Sammy Anderson for being with us and Sandra Luce Lara Sinisomo. She teaches kinesiology and she's a community health professor at the University of Illinois. We'll tweet out all of Sandra Luce's research as well for those of you who are interested in learning more about it. We'll have it up at our website at 21stshow.org as well. Sammy, Sandra Luce, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today and for this week. I hope everyone has a safe, happy, relaxing Memorial Day weekend. On Monday, we are not going to be here in studio, but we will be bringing you one of our favorite shows from the past year about the best foods of the Midwest. So if you've got cookout plans for the weekend or if you just like eating, be sure to tune in. I mentioned our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can also follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. If you want to search for the 21st to like us, you can comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or if you just need to remember our social media handles, all you have to do is go to our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows there. You can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, iTunes, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Apolson is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.